I'm an addict. My name's Danny.
Hey, Danny.
How you feeling? Thank God for Narcotics Anonymous. And I definitely believe that this is a given program from God. And I'd like to take a second, we all could be in a moment of silence, and thank God for this beautiful thing called Narcotics Anonymous that we all can live by and live a better life. Thank you. Okay, I want everybody to know I ain't no Greg Pierce up here doing a history of NA, but I want to do the best that I can. Greg was clean since 72. Now, I only been clean since 86, but I've studied a lot, and I've been through a lot of people's garages and basements and attics digging stuff up, and I spent a lot of money trying to get this stuff together, and I'm going to do the best that I can. We got evidence that dates back to 1944 that on the East Coast up in New York that Narcotics Anonymous started. It was a guy named Daniel Carlson who started in Lexington, Kentucky prison. And Narcotics Anonymous had started several different times on the East Coast and had folded all these different times. And they say that August 17th, 1953 was the actual founding date for Narcotics Anonymous, which is true in one hand and not true in another. The reason why it's true in one hand, since August 17th, 1953, there has been an ongoing meeting of Narcotics Anonymous as we know it today. And that's why it's true in one hand. But also, this guy, Daniel Carlson, tried to start it up in 1944 up in New York. And I have some literature here that, you know, that states that. And I'm going to read a couple things from it. NA began when the first two addicts seeking recovery got together and they could stay clean through their common desire. God only knows where and when this occurred. There is a written record of an organization similar to AA which operates among addicts in 1944. References is made this in Alcohol Science and Society, page 472. The earliest reference we know of Narcotics Anonymous is from the Addicts, page 166, published in 1953. Which mentions a founding date of 1948 by Daniel Carlson in New York City. Articles in the Saturday Evening Post, Newsweek, and Time in 1950 and 51 speak of NA spreading to other major cities like Chicago and Los Angeles. More work needs to be done to reference these dates for accuracy. And this, I have a little article right here. I can't really make this out because it's a copy, so I want to go on with that. But I know in 1954, there was this lady, and her name was Betty, and Betty T. She started a recovery process thing called habit-forming drugs. And I have some literature here, and it goes back to 1950, maybe even before that. November 1950 is the oldest thing I got on that. And she's got 12 suggestions that may be help to anyone addicted to drugs. One, we should be convinced from our own experience that our reaction to alcohol and drugs is so abnormal that any indulgence for us constitutes a totally impossible and undesirable way of life. Two, we should completely sincere in our desire to stop using alcohol and habit-forming drugs of any type. Once and for all, no compromise. Three, we should clearly understand that once we have attained sobriety and abstinence, we can never again use alcohol or drugs. Four, we should be convinced that alcohol, narcotics, and any habit-forming drugs bring to us not happiness, but unhappiness in its purest form. Five, we should come to realize that we have been trying to substitute a drug fantasy for real achievement in life. Six, we should realize that any responsibility, intelligent, and sincere person who is willing to make a sustained effort for a sufficient period of time is capable of learning to live without alcohol or drugs. Seven, we should never be so foolish as to try to persuade ourselves that we can use alcohol or drugs just once in a while. Remember that no alcohol or addict has ever been able to indulge in his habit just once in a while without becoming a full-fledged alcoholic or addict in an incredible short time. 8, we should learn to disregard the dumb advice and often dumber questions of well-meaning friends and relatives without becoming emotionally disturbed. 9, we should be particularly on guard during periods of our life when we are upset or depressed. We all are depressed occasionally, but these depressions pass naturally if given time. To turn to alcohol or drugs to blank out a depression is just as sensible as cutting off your head to cure a headache. 10, whenever we find ourselves remembering the pleasures of using drugs or alcohol, remember also the deceit, degradation, and heartaches that they brought us. Remember the abject misery of withdrawal from them when you wake up to find yourself a thoroughly beaten, friendless, and useless shell of the person you once were. Remember these things well and then try to think about something worthwhile. 11, we should learn to relax both physically and mentally without the use of alcohol, narcotics, or any habit-forming drugs. 12, we should be exceedingly careful of drugs as a substitute for alcohol and never start self-administration of any drug. The only way for us is to leave drugs strictly alone except under the supervision of a competent medical practitioner skilled in the treatment of addiction or alcoholism, prescribes and supervises such treatment. To the narcotic addict or any addict to habit-forming drugs, remember, there is nothing that alcohol can do for you that good, clean living and thinking cannot do better. And that was by Betty T., HFD Group, November 1950. What I'm getting at by reading these things to you is, you know, in the 40s and the early 50s, people were trying to help addicts get off a drug. AA was well on its way. That was established in 35. And people knew that alcohol, that addiction was different than alcoholism. And they were trying to start programs, and they had kept folding. There's one thing here I want to read. This is from May 7th, 1951. The white stuff. Young Danny had an obsessed ear to ease the pain. A doctor in St. Joseph, Missouri gave him morphine. Danny had been an insured troubled child longer than he could remember. Both his mother and father died before he was 5 at 16. Danny knew nothing about psychology, but he knew that the shot gave him a lift from a peddler. He got morphine regularly for 6 months. Then he lost his contact and could get no more. He became weak, nauseated, sweaty, shaking, depressed. Danny was sent to a state hospital. No such thing as a cure. Danny learned a lot in the hospital. Veteran growers taught him how to get a ration of white stuff. When he got out, Danny did not go home. He bummed around the country doing odd jobs, living, stealing, giving prescriptions, anything for a bang. Time and again, he was picked up and convicted, usually to serve a sentence in the U.S. Public Health Service's hospital for narcotic addicts at Lexington, Kentucky. They can withdraw, you say, Danny, but there is no such thing as a cure. You just have to stay away from the stuff. Between turns, when Danny seemed to be away from the habit, he got married. Before the first baby was a year old, Danny was shot up again. When his wife left him, he tried to commit suicide, so back to Lexington. Up to this point, Danny's story had deadly familiar ring. Every year, thousands of teenagers take the first step to narcotic addiction, usually by smoking a reefer cigarette containing marijuana, because they don't want to be called chicken. Dope peddlers have been pushing their wares through the high schools and street gangs. Now, estimated number of addicts range anywhere from 50,000 to 300,000. So he's talking about addiction all the way back then, and that, you know, there's a serious problem back then. And this guy was pretty serious about helping people, and he was working through penitentiaries because he knew that most addicts wound up in jail, you know, and that's how he started trying to start his program. And like I said, his program had died. But August 17th, 1953, a committee of 6 formed. And what happened was the first meeting started. And there were 17 people in the first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, how we know it today. And it started in Sun Valley, California. And they called Jimmy Kinnon the founder of Narcotics Anonymous, and the reason why they called him the founder, there were 17 people there at the first original meeting, but what had happened was Jimmy Kinnon was the backbone of Narcotics Anonymous. He's the guy that pushed it, he's the guy that got involved and started meetings, he's the guy that got in the writing our literature and everything. 1956, this is a copy of the 1956 white book that Jimmy Kinnon wrote. That was our first piece of literature. And I have an original one, but I don't want to bring it. And there's a couple things in here about the 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3 is the same, 4 is the same, 5 is the same, 6 is the same, 7, 8, 9. They're all the same. But there was one other thing. Here's the one thing that I wanted to read about. It says, these drug addicts cure one another. And it came out of the Evening Post, 1953. And it says in here that it says years before there was a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And that's how they say it dates back to 1948, because when they say years before, and Greg found something, this is from August 7th, 1951, and he said he found some literature in that science stuff about Narcotics Anonymous that dated back to 1944. So as we move along, probably the first NA meeting that I think folded, but it was in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Cleveland, Ohio is where a lot of AA people were, and I have a newsletter for Narcotics Anonymous from Cleveland, Ohio that dates back to 64, but I'm pretty sure that meeting had folded, and here's where Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast was founded and formed as I know it and as we know it today. In 1969, there was this guy named Roy P. His father was a doctor, and his father and mother got divorced, and his father moved out on the West Coast, and he was going to AA, and he had this big AA guru sponsor. And his sponsor always told him he was an addict. So he was going out on the West Coast to go visit his father. So this guy who was sponsoring him told him that he knew of a thing called Narcotics Anonymous in California. And when he got out there, stop in and check it out. So when this guy, Roy P., came back from California, he brought back the first white book. And this is a copy of the first white book that he brought back. And what happened was he went to Eagleville because he didn't know where any other addicts were. And he had started the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting in 1969 at Eagleville Hospital. But he had relapsed about 6 months after that, and the meeting had went on for a little bit and then had died after that. And then in 71, six guys got together in Eagleville again, and that white book was still floating around in Eagleville, and these six guys got together and they started Narcotics Anonymous. And the actual first one that started was either late 71 or early 72, and was started in Norristown, Pennsylvania, Green and Basin Streets. And it had moved out of Green and Basin Street to Plymouth Meeting Mall, and it was called Sobriety on the Mall. And shortly after that, it was changed to Recovery on the Mall. And that meeting is still going on, and last month they just celebrated a 21-year anniversary. And I went to the 20-year anniversary, and it was pretty good. Some of the guys that started the meeting were there, and I had sat down and talked to them and got some information off them. It was pretty neat being at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. It was 20 years old. Anyway, Narcotics Anonymous, in 1972, we were the second largest region in the whole world. We had 16 meetings in our region. And our region wasn't Philadelphia region, it was called Mid-Atlantic region. And it existed of Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Harrisburg, Philadelphia. It was real big. And they had regional meetings twice a year. People traveled many miles to come to this thing. And then after that, in like 82, there was a lot of dissension between this Mid-Atlantic region and Philadelphia. We wanted to break off and start our own region, and they weren't real happy with us doing that. And we did it anyway. And we were in 76, we had started our, 74, I'm sorry, we had started our own thing called Intergroup, which we adopted from Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was like our first area service thing. And then in 76, the World Service sent out the NA3, which was our Narcotics Anonymous structure, how we changed names to area service, to regional meetings, to WSO and stuff like that, World Service Office and World Service Conference, and that educated us. In 75, we kept sending letters out to the World Service Office trying to get some literature. And we had gotten letters back that there was a shortage on literature. So what happened was Philadelphia bootlegged their own white books. And as you can see, they weren't even white. This is a real bootleg from back in early 76. And that was our literature. Until finally what happened was that WSO, they made copies of their literature and they mailed it out to us on the East Coast. And, once there was literature, it was a lot easier because the way these people were doing meetings were whoever screamed the loudest, that's who they paid attention to, or whoever had the most time. It wasn't who had the most knowledge or who knew best, and that's how they did it. It was, back then it was called white knuckle sobriety, but these people, what they did was there was a group of them, and there was only like a dozen or so of them, and they just hung tough, man. At their first anniversary, the first year anniversary of that meeting, nobody showed up. And about an hour into the meeting, a busload of people came from a rehab. And they were like, they couldn't believe it. New faces walked into the door. And they were all over them, 12-stepping them and everything. But people like Dutch H and Ray T, they're the people who made Narcotics Anonymous happen on the East Coast. They were starting meetings all over. They were going to rehab. Back in the first meeting that ever started in Philadelphia, actually Philadelphia, was at 10th and Roosevelt Boulevard. The white priest and all wouldn't allow us to start meetings in the room because they heard drug addicts and stuff like that. But the black priest, that was the only place we could get meetings, was in the black neighborhoods. And the first one started in 1973 in Philadelphia. And it was at 10th and Roosevelt Boulevard. And that meeting moved in 1976 to Oxford Circle. And that meeting is still alive today. It's been going on since 73. The one, like I said, up at Green and Basin, that moved to Recovery on the Mall. And that's still going on, which is 21 years old. It's the first regional chairperson for the Philadelphia region was John F., and he also was the first RSR. They said, you do it temporarily because you know the most about service, and he wound up doing it. His temporary position wound up being like 9 months. But area service met in Norristown on Main Street, then it moved to Norristown at the YWCA, then it moved to Plymouth Meeting Mall, then it moved down to 22nd and Chestnut and was there for 4 years. Then it moved to Harbison and the Boulevard in a dental clinic. And then it moved to Maternity BVM Church. And then it rotated in different areas in hotels. And then it wound up at the Howard Johnson. I want to talk a little bit about conventions, because that's why we're all here, to enjoy the celebration of recovery. And I believe that's what conventions are for. The first World Convention was November 5th. 1971. It was in La Mirada, California. The second one was September 1st to the 3rd, and that was in 72 in North Hollywood. And the third was in 73 in California, and the fourth was in California too in 74. And they were in California. Like, in the early 70s, they didn't know that there was other Narcotics Anonymous meetings. They didn't know that that guy, Ward P, came out and was going to start a meeting in the northeastern part of the United States. And then at the fifth, they had a theme. That was the first theme. It was called We Came to Believe, and that was September 26, 1975, in Santa Rosa, California. And the sixth was coming together in November 12th, 76, in Ventura, California. The seventh was also in California in 77. And then the first time it went out of California was the 8th World Convention in 1978, September 21st. It was in Houston, Texas, and it was called Carry the Message to Houston. And then the 9th was I Can't, We Can, and that was September 6th, 1979, and that was held in Atlanta, Georgia. And then the 10th, the Ties That Bind Us Together, was September 4th, 1980, in Wichita, Kansas. And it's funny, a lot of these places, Houston, Georgia, there was the World Literature Conferences were meeting at them places too, and we were trying to get our book together. The 11th was Together More Than Ever, and that was in Miami, Florida in 81. The 12th was Our Gratitude Speaks, and that was in 82 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The 13th was The Impossible Dream in New York City in 1983. The 14th was Miracles Happen in Chicago, Illinois in 84. The 15th was Unified and Staying Alive in 85, and that was in Washington, D.C., September of 85. And then it was the first time out of the United States it went to London, and the theme was Live from London. That was August 28, 86. And then the 17th was Live Your Dreams, and that was September 3rd, 87, and that was in New Orleans, Louisiana. The 18th was Once a Dream, Now a Reality in Anaheim, California in 88. And the 19th was The Magic is Real in 89 in Orlando, Florida. The 20th, Recovery, The Journey Continues. That was in Portland, Oregon in 90. Last year was in Sydney, Australia, another time that it went out of the United States. That was The Gift. That was October 4th, 91. And this year it's going to be called Imagine the Freedom, September 3rd to the 6th, 1992 in Toronto, Canada. The World Literature Conference is really what made Narcotics Anonymous explode. Like I was saying, in 72, there was about 200 meetings in the world. And that's when it started taking off in 1972. But when our book came out, and we had a book, and we could see something real, and literature was being written and being sent back to regions, and people were approving it and disapproving it, and we were organizing real well then, that's when Narcotics Anonymous really took off, which was in the early 80s. And the first World Lit Conference was in 79 in Wichita, Kansas. And then a whole year went by. And then it went to Lincoln, Nebraska in 1980. That was the second. Third was in January, and that was in Memphis, Tennessee. And the fourth was in Santa Monica, California in 81. And the fifth was June in Warren, Ohio in 81. The sixth was September 14th, 81 in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then the next three were right here in Pennsylvania. The seventh was in Ivyland, Pennsylvania. The eighth were in different people's houses. It was changing around at different people's houses. And the ninth was in Jamison, Pennsylvania. And what happened in them last three is they wrote the storybook. You look in the back of your basic text, there's different stories. They were written here in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania and a lot of Bucks County had a lot to do with the writing of the basic text. People were selling stuff. A guy sold his washer so he could go out to Wichita, Kansas to be at the first World Lit Conference. He wanted to be involved. He wanted this thing to explode, you know. And a lot of people from Pennsylvania, and like I said, preferably from Bucks County, followed this World Lit Conference. They went from state to state doing this thing. And, you know, as I said, it started in 79 and it ended in 83. So for 4 years, this thing was... this book was being written and everything. And what happened was, in Tennessee, they came out with this book. This was the first book. It was an approval form, and it got shot down. And then the next book that came out was the Gray Book. The Gray Book was written, copied, and sent out to every region in the world in 29 days. And, you know, it only added to do that. And then... the Red Book came out, which was a special edition, and they charged, only 2,500 of them were made, and they charged $25 so they could raise extra funds so they could put out the first edition. The real first edition is a light blue, not like the blue that we show today. It says right on it, Works, and it has that logo on it. And they sold that for $8, and 2,500 of them were made. And it seems that the blue books are a lot harder to get than the red books. And the red books are numbered. This red book here is number 11. That's the 11th book was ever printed in the world. And so the basic text, you know, the first printing, there was like 5,000 of them made. And back here in Philadelphia, our RSR at the time was Dutch H. He went out to California. Jimmy Kinnon gave him a box of 49 of them. He brought them back here on the East Coast, and when they had the motion to pass for this book, Philadelphia didn't pass it. And when Dutch came back here with these books, nobody wanted the books. He drove around with them in his trunk for like 6 months to a year because nobody wanted them. Nobody wanted them in Philadelphia because we disapproved it. But it passed anyway, and they published it. And a few basic texts would burn up in a fire. And anyway, finally people started wanting them. And, you know, it's funny. Now today, man, you can get one for $1,000, you know. So I believe personally that it was the book, man, because we had something to read by. We had something to go by. We had stories in it. We had, you know, it in living color and proof in black and white. And millions of books have been written. They say if you want to learn anything, go look in the library. You can find it in a book. So now that we had this book, man, that's when the fellowship started taking off and people got involved in service. The East Coast Convention, the first East Coast Convention was called Never Alone, and that started June 1980. And the reason, and it started in Bucknell University. And as we know it today, it's called Williamsport Area. Back then it wasn't. But Williamsport Area started that first East Coast Convention. And the reason why they started it in a university to keep the cost down, because it was cheap. And the colleges were out, and it was easy to get these frat rooms that we stay in. And it's been, the East Coast probably is one of the biggest traditions of conventions, because it's always been in June, and it's always been at a university. And the chairperson of the whole convention always was the chairperson at the banquet. And the second East Coast was called Glad to Be Alive, and that was at Trenton State University. Now, Philadelphia hosted the Trenton State University. We couldn't get a facility here in Philadelphia, and we found one over in Trenton. So we went over there, and we supported it, and a guy from Philadelphia, from Bucks County, was the chair and everything. And what had happened was, back then, people believed that conventions violated tradition, some people didn't, and there had been a world convention going on for 10 years now. It was the tenth world. So finally these guys got together and they started the East Coast Convention. And Philadelphia didn't get a convention going for 3 years after this was going on. But anyway, the third East Coast Convention was called Miracles Happen, and that was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And the fourth East Coast was Freedom Through Fellowship, which was at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The fifth was called Reaching Out at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. And that's another tradition that they got. Right now, they're probably going to have a big committee on where this convention goes next. What they would do is each year they would bid on it for the next year. And that was another tradition. So like I said, this thing's real traditionalized, how the East Coast continues. The sixth was called Together We Can, and that was at Towson State University in Baltimore, Maryland. The seventh was Free at Last in 1986 at Bloomsburg University in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. The eighth was Our Way, Not Mine in Kent, Ohio in 87. The ninth was A Vision of Hope in June of 88 at Durham, New Hampshire. The tenth was Let the Miracle Happen, and that was in June of 89 at Buffalo, New York, University of Buffalo. The 11th was Surrender is the Key, and that was in Wayne, New Jersey. The 12th was Courage to Change at University of Maryland, at College Park, Maryland. And the 13th, we're here now, The Gift of Listening at Temple University. Like I said, convention, there was a lot of bickering back and forth of conventions and that they broke traditions and they did and da 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 da. So in 1983, there was a few guys together and they went to their area and they asked their area to donate some money. They wanted to start a Philadelphia convention and their area turned them down. They went to another area and that area turned them down. So this guy, John S., he said, I got $100, man, to start a convention. And Dutch H., he said, I'll match it. And he put up $100. And then this other guy, Bobby B., he put up $100. And what they did was they took that $300 and they went down the shore and they gambled and they won. They hit the $1,200. And that's how the first convention started here in Philadelphia. It started at 4th and Arch at the Holiday Inn. And it was, and they put it together in like 3 weeks. And it only happened for one day. It was real small. And it was called Celebration of Service in Unity. We finally did it. That was the name, that was the theme. And that was April 16th, 1983. And since then, there's been a convention in Philadelphia ever since. And I'm running down the list of the names of them. The second one was in 84 of April, and it was called A Time to Come Together. The third was in 85, and it was called A Celebration of Life Through Fellowship. The fourth was in 86. And all these are April so far. When the day changes, I'll tell you. And it was Together We Grow. And then the fifth moved to March, and it was called Step Up to Recovery. That was the first convention that I ever went to, and it was amazing, man. It was the best. I haven't cleaned since. The sixth was in March also, and that was called Spiritual Connection. The seventh was in February of 89, and that was called The Miracle Continues. And the guy who's chairing this convention was the chair for that. That's probably how he got the position here, because he had previous experience with it. The eighth was in March of 90 and was called The Principles We Unite. The ninth was The Ties That Bind Us Together, and that was in March. And then the tenth was The Promises Freedom, A Decade of Growth, and that was in April. And it's amazing how Narcotics Anonymous grew and got big quick. In 1973, I have a meeting list in one of these books here, and it's in 1973, there were 7 meetings in the whole Philadelphia area. And the newest meeting list that we have, I counted them while I was sitting here waiting for you guys to come, there's 428 meetings in our region now, you know. And there's thousands of recovering addicts. We're in 40 different countries. The growth of Narcotics Anonymous is tremendous. The last I heard, and this was a couple years ago, that there's over 10,000 meetings in the world. And that, like I said, that was a few years ago. I haven't updated that or anything. I want you to know, I brought a couple archives here for you to look at, some old things. Probably the oldest thing is the N.A. Treaties, which were written in 76. The red book, the gray book was in 83. The red book was, I think, in 83. The gray book's in 82, I think. The red book's in 83. And I got some other books up here. I got stuff from all the world conventions from the first all the way up, except for 3 of them. I got stuff from all the East Coast conventions. I got some meeting lists, all the Philadelphia and surrounding Philadelphia areas from 73 up to now. People want to look at them. And then I have pamphlets, different pamphlets, information pamphlets that were written. And there's a few of them that are pretty interesting. A lot of people probably have never seen them. There's one that's called So You Love an Addict. And what happened was Reg's wife, who was a member of NAR and I, wrote it. And it was submitted to Narcotics Anonymous, and it was approved at the time. So You Love an Addict. And then they changed it quickly after that to For Those We Love and Others. And there's a couple other pretty neat ones. We Made a Decision, which isn't around anymore. And I think the coolest one I like is the 4-step one. It was written by Greg Pierce, and it's called Getting Realer. And I don't think it was ever approved, but I know that he wrote it and submitted it. Yeah, review material not for distribution. It's called Getting Realer, A Guide to the 4-Step. And then there's a couple different ones, The Physician's Viewpoint. And Greg Pierce also wrote a Triangle of Self-Obsession, The Use of Medication in Recovery. So we had a lot of different trials and tribulations with Narcotics Anonymous, a lot of stuff was so-called taking off the market. All I know is that Narcotics Anonymous definitely works, man. We're all miracles. We're all here. You know, I'm proud to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for having me speak on it. How I opened up was, you know, God gave us this program, and I believe it was definitely through God, and I believe God works through people. And there's a lot of people in this fellowship who worked hard, real hard. I mean, dedicated hours and weeks and months and years to this thing called Narcotics Anonymous. So thousands and thousands and thousands of us could recover. Jimmy Kinnon always had a dream, and what it was to fill up a stadium up, have a world convention in the stadium. And I believe someday, man, that's going to happen. Someday we're going to have our world conventions in stadiums, you know, where there's 60, 70, 100,000 people coming to a world convention. And, you know, it's all because of God, and it's all because of hard work from us. And, you know, I got to say, it's the most beautiful thing that ever happened to me, man, was finding this fellowship, because I wasn't living out there, you know. And today I'm able to say I live. I make goals. I conquer them. And if anybody's got any questions, or afterwards want to look at any of this stuff, where I got a bunch of archives back in my house. If anybody wants copies of stuff, I'll give them my phone number. They can come over and get copies. One of the ladies here today asked me to make her some copies, and I did. And I send stuff to a guy in Florida all the time, and he sends me stuff. And I want to spread the history. I want everybody to know about the history, man. And, you know, unfortunately, there's not a real lot of archives around like this. There's probably, I don't know, 10, 20 collectors in the world. I know that I got one of the biggest collections in the world, probably the top 20 or something. And I know Greg Pierce got one of the largest. And Betty Kinnon, the guy who so-called founded Narcotics Anonymous, his wife's got a pretty big collection, but she don't really let anybody see it. I want anybody who wants to come to my house and look at my stuff to become, because it's ours, and I'll tell you why it's ours. Because how I got into doing this thing, at the 6th Philadelphia Convention, I did the artwork that was approved for the shirts and the mugs and the banners and all, and my ego got involved in it. And then after my ego got involved in it, it took off. I started collecting stuff. And like I said, I ripped through people's basements, garage, attics, and everything, and people gave me stuff. Some stuff I had to buy, or some stuff I traded, or whatever. But if it wasn't for people giving me stuff, I wouldn't have it. And that's why I want to give it back to the fellowship. And like, at the 7th or 8th Philly convention, I went to our RSO, our regional service office, and I took my whole collection, and I plopped it on the floor, and I said, here, man, this is for you guys. And like 2 weeks later, they called me up, they said, we don't want this stuff here, there's not enough room. And to be honest with you, I'm so glad that they did that, man, because it's back in my house, and I can play with it whenever I want. I can get obsessed over it. I can go nuts. And if it was down there, I'd have to knock on their door to let me in to do it, you know? But anybody that wants to come see the stuff or whatever, you know, I'll give you my phone number. And if anybody's got questions or anybody wants to come up and share, I know there's a couple people who can elaborate on what I was saying, like Danny. And so I'm going to shut up. Thanks for listening to me, guys.
My name is Michael, and I'm an addict, and this is y'all part of the meeting. I'll turn it back over to Daniel.
Anybody want to share? Anybody got questions?
I'm an addict.
Come on up.
My question.
You answered many of my questions. I was absolutely fascinated that the fellowship had been around since 1953. And having been in AA meetings and seeing people sitting around a table, five or six strong with 27 years or more, and then knowing that we've been around since 53, and then at an anniversary meeting, somebody stands up with 13 years, then it drops down all of a sudden to 7 years with two, then maybe two sixes, a couple of fours, then all the threes and the twos start getting into the thing. I said, well, where are the veterans with the time? And then I found out that it was on the East Coast, only a few years compared to the West Coast, and you've documented a lot of that struggle. My question is about the name. Someone had said that one time they thought about calling it Live Addicts, but they didn't want to get it confused with AA, and somehow they bantered it around and they came up with Narcotics. And I would just like to know just how the name of kind of synonymous form of what went into that thinking. We say all drugs and narcotics is a drug, but we do some things called caffeine and nicotine and so forth. And that was that really, one's like a speed, one's like a downer, or what have you. But why just narcotics and not all other things? How did they get into that name? I'd like to know about that. Thank you.
To answer it the best that I can, that I understand back in the day they tried to call it Addicts Anonymous. And the AA letters infringed on the AA name of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, it also failed. And how they came up with Narcotics Anonymous, I'm not sure exactly. But I could also say that, like you said, there's people in here with 16 years and then it all of a sudden drops down. The only thing I could say for that is, I guess, addicts are more stubborn than the alcoholic, I guess. I don't know. But I know there's people who have 20 years on the East Coast. You know, I know a guy that's got 20 years in Narcotics Anonymous. That's where he found his recovery, and that's where he stayed for his recovery.